Last week, we were talking about sleep, the health and economic implications in particular. The economists Matthew Gibson and Jeffrey Schrader stumbled upon a great natural experiment.
Almost as though we go out in the United States and force people to sleep different amounts and then watch what the outcome is on their wages.
That's Gibson.
And it turns out that ever since we've put time zones into place, we've basically been running just that sort of giant experiment on everyone in America.
Consider two cities like Huntsville, Alabama, and Amarillo, Texas. They're roughly the same size and on the same latitude, so they get the same amount of daylight, but they are on opposite ends of the same time zone. So in Huntsville, the sun sets a full hour earlier than in Amarillo. And thanks to that...
Well, it turns out that the human body, our sleep cycle, responds more strongly to the sun than it does to the clock. So people who live in Huntsville and experience this earlier sunset go to bed earlier.
But since we set our alarms according to the time, not the sun, that means that people in Huntsville and Amarillo wake up at roughly the same time. But, and this is the big but, people in Huntsville, on the eastern edge of the time zone, get roughly a full hour more sleep per week than the people in Amarillo. Here, just for kicks, is Tommy Battle, the mayor of Huntsville.
I'm an early to bed person. I'm 9:30 to 10. I'm in bed.
And here, from Amarillo, is Marcia Schrader. She is the mother of one of the economists who did the time zone study.
Normally, I will get to bed by midnight or a little bit before midnight. Just the last couple of weeks, I can't make myself go to bed before 2 o'clock in the morning.
But since Huntsville and Amarillo are in the same time zone, people start work at roughly the same time, which means alarm clocks go off at roughly the same time.
That means if you go to bed earlier in Huntsville, you sleep longer.
Gibson and Schrader found a significant difference in sleep duration between Huntsville and Amarillo.
If I dose you, the person in Huntsville, with a 1 hour earlier sunset time, how much more do you sleep? And the answer is something like an hour per week. And this is what I mean when I say it's like we've been running a giant experiment. We've effectively been giving different locations in America different bedtimes based on where they are east to west within a time zone.
Gibson says he found the same effect in all time zones in the U.S., and it's been identified in other countries, including Germany.
The question then is, does that have any impact? We have this variation in sleep that is clean, that is like an experiment, but does it actually change economic outcomes? If I compare the wages of people in Huntsville to wages of people on the western edge of the time zone, what change in wage does that difference in sunset produce?
So now Gibson and Schrader plugged in wage data for Huntsville versus Amarillo and other pairs of cities that had a similar sleep gap.
And we find that permanently increasing sleep by an hour per week for everybody in a city increases the wages in that location by about 4.5%.
4.5%, that's a pretty good payout for just one extra hour of sleep per week. If you get an extra hour per night, Gibson and Schrader discovered. Here, let me quote you their paper. Our main result is that sleeping one extra hour per night on average increases wages by 16%, highlighting the importance of restedness to human productivity. 16%, really?
That seems huge to me.
That's Dan Hammermesh. He was one of the first economists to study sleep. He read an early copy of the Time Zone paper.
I thought it was huge when I saw it, and I really wonder about that. It just seems too big, much too big that to be credible.
I think that's a reasonable reaction, right? We all have some prior number floating around our heads about what that number should be. And for me and for most people to whom I've spoken about this paper, that 16% number is quite high.
High enough that if all else were equal, you might think about moving to a place like Huntsville if you lived in a place like Amarillo, because you'll get more sleep and make more money. For what it's worth, the median income in Huntsville is substantially higher than in Amarillo, although it might be reckless to pin that whole difference on sleep. We did ask Marcia Schrader in Amarillo what she made of her son's findings.
I'm terribly disappointed and feeling very ripped off. I think Amarillo's per capita income is rather low on the national scale, but I never would have thought it was anything correlated with time zone. That explains a lot. I never earned more than $20,000 as a teacher.
The paper does note, however, that with higher incomes in a city come higher real estate prices. As they write, our wage effects are fully offset by increased home prices.
And so workers don't have an incentive to move in response to those sunset doses.
That said, Gibson was surprised by the magnitude of their results. A 16% income boost from one more hour per night of sleep. That's a bigger boost than you'd expect from one additional year of education. But if you start feeling skeptical, he says, just think about the huge negative effects from sleep deprivation.
So beginning about 10 or 15 years ago, we started to see experiments in medical school where they would subject people to levels of sleep that are closer to real-world sleep deprivation, 6 hours a night, maybe 4 hours a night, for periods from 7 to 21 days, 1 to 3 weeks. And they found very, very large effects on task performance, on these lab type of tasks.
Right away, you see the cognitive effects.
David Dinges is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania.
Attention becomes unstable. We have trouble thinking fast. Cognitive processing speed is markedly reduced. Short-term memory begins to fail. We can't hold things in our memory as well as when we're fully alert.
Dinges and his colleagues have conducted several important sleep trials over the years.
The less sleep we gave people at night, so if we went from 7 or 8 hours a night down to 6 or 5, the more we got this cumulative rate of buildup of these deficits, they got worse every day. When the sleep got very short, down to 4 hours or 3 hours, they got worse every day very rapidly and very dramatically. So there was a dose response function. The less sleep you got chronically, the more rapidly you deteriorated. So the two things you see first are you cannot sustain attention for very long. You try to compensate by then becoming impulsive. So what happens with paradoxically with chronic sleep restriction is people will be slow to respond or lapse, and then they'll be overly impulsive and maybe talk or interact a lot and then suddenly be out of it again. And that instability in attention is the hallmark of sleep loss, but very close behind it and equivalent to it is your cognitive processing speed. You simply cannot think as fast and solve a problem as quickly when you're sleep deprived as when you're not sleep deprived.
So you can think of a number of ways that lack of sleep could translate into working worse or working more sloppily or less productively and add up to such big income gains for people who sleep more. Matthew Gibson again.
One reason in all likelihood that it's big is it reflects these spillovers across workers, the fact that if you're more productive and we work in the same office, you help make me more productive. There also may be some really long-run effects on how places develop because of the permanently higher sleep in a location. So you might think, for example, if you own an IT company and you're at the eastern edge of a time zone, your workers are permanently more productive because they sleep more. That might lead you to invest more in computers with which those workers can produce goods or services.
Okay, so that is pretty compelling evidence that extra sleep can pay off. But how much does it matter when you sleep? Today, we're going to look at some research that suggests the early bird really does get the worm.
You could call it a premium for getting up early in the morning.
But first, here are some of your sleeping habits.
My name is Spencer Rothfuss. I'm 16 years old and live in Omaha, Nebraska. I sleep fully dressed in the next day's clothes, so I'm ready to go in the morning.
My name is Mark Allen. I'm calling from North Queensland in Australia. What do I wear? Butt naked, I think, is the American way of saying it.
Hi, my name is Alexandra Nicholas, and currently I am based in Montgomery, Alabama. I've actually been keeping a spreadsheet on my sleep, which is super nerdy, but I have times when I went to sleep, when I woke up, when I actually got out of bed, how many alarms were required to make me get out of bed.
Hi, my name is Adam Hill, and eating dinner late actually improves my sleep quality.
I'm Tommy Battle, mayor of the city of Huntsville, Alabama. Been mayor for 7 years now, and all my habits are my wife's habits because she turns on the fan, and I never would have a fan on, but she also has it down to about meat locker temperature in the room, and I cover up real heavy.
This is Rebecca Miller, and I live in Pleasant Grove, Utah,
In high school or college, I would work the graveyard shift, and so I would sleep in a closet sometimes and wrap like a shirt around my head so that I would convince my body that I was sleeping at night when really it was the daytime.
My name is Keisha Waldschmidt, and I have always been teased that I look like I'm dead when I'm sleeping. I sleep on my back with my arms folded across my chest, straight as an arrow.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hello, this is Stephen Dubner.
Are you a morning person?
Good morning.
Do you greet the day with a smile, ready to get things underway?
What do you want to do?
Daddy, I want to wake up.
That's Camille, 2 years old, and her father, Christopher Worth. He's one of the producers on our show. Camille likes to get up around 6 a.m.
Yay!
Dad wouldn't mind getting up a little bit later.
Big yawn.
But let's face it, getting up early is good training for the rest of your life. School, work, all those things that start in the morning.
Society is structured in a way that it favors morning-type people more than evening-type people.
That's Jens Bonke. He's an economist and a senior researcher at the Rockwool Foundation in Copenhagen. He studies things like time use and family economics. If you are a night owl, he says, staying up late and getting up late, it can feel like the world with its morning start times is against you.
And for that reason, I said, well, if the morning type people are favored, they might also be more productive and they might earn more than evening type people.
In other words, after reading the work of Dan Hammermesh and others about how the amount of sleep we get has an economic effect, he wondered about the effect of when you sleep.
And that was what I decided to investigate. And my assumption was that there might be a relationship between when you sleep and how much you earn.
First, he needed to separate the population into early birds and night owls. The ideal way to do that, he decided, would be to map everyone's genes. Bonke says we all have a distinct gene that influences our chronotype, that is, a given person's proclivity for waking up early or late. But it would have been way too expensive to gene map the entire population of Denmark, which, granted, is pretty small, about 5.5 million people. So he turned to a Danish time use survey that covers more than 10,000 people, a rather exhaustive time use survey.
We have a lot of information on every Dane in this country here.
One issue with sleep data is that when people wake up during the week isn't necessarily representative of their true chronotype. Even night owls have to get up for work.
So what I did was to say, well, what happens to people during the weekend?
On the weekend, he figured, your true sleep nature emerges. Early birds would still get up relatively early, and night owls would revert to staying up late and sleeping late. Once he was able to separate the early birds from the night owls in the data, he compared their incomes.
There was a significant differential in the sense that morning type people earn 4 or 5% more than evening type people.
4 to 5% more for the early risers. And that's controlling for family background, education level, and so on. Bonke believes the reason for this is pretty simple. If you're a morning person, you wake up on time feeling rested, since your body naturally told you to go to bed earlier. He found that early risers get a bit more sleep overall. Night owls, meanwhile, spend their lives sort of posing as early birds, getting up early because they have to, but staying up late because that's what their chronotype dictates. That doesn't seem fair, does it, to get punished in the workforce because of your night owl genes? So what should be done? Bonke argues that more flexibility in the workplace, even in the very pace of the day, would be a big help. The good news is that in Denmark, at least, that's been happening. Danish companies used to enforce strict office hours, and Danish law used to prevent a lot of businesses from being open when a lot of people might like them to be open.
You couldn't do shopping in most places after 2 p.m. on Saturdays until Monday morning. And at most workplaces, you had to be there from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
But that's been changing. Employers are more flexible. Shopping laws have been liberalized, all of which makes it easier to be a night owl. And Banca claims to have found evidence in the data that this really has paid off for night owls. Remember, he recently found that early birds make 4 to 5% more than night owls. He compared this result with the same data from 10 years ago.
And there I could see that the premium for getting up early has decreased considerably over this period.
A decade ago, early birds earned 10 to 12% more than night owls. So the payoff for getting up early, or if you prefer to look at it from the other side, the penalty for being a night owl, has more than halved in a relatively short time. This trend that increased flexibility in society helps certain people prosper might explain another finding in his data, that the wage difference between early and late risers is higher for men than for women.
The fact is that at least at the Danish labor market, but probably on most labor markets, many more women have flexible working hours and part-time work, so they can find a more appropriate time of the day to work than it's possible for men.
So there would seem to be compelling evidence on a lot of dimensions that sleep really matters for how much we earn, how we make decisions, how we feel, and in the long run, how long we live. If you live in a rich country, like the United States, Denmark, it's natural to think about how sleep can help us improve a few percentage points here and there. But think about how big the sleep gains could be in a developing country. This is Chennai, the sixth largest city in India.
Which actually means it's huge. It's actually bigger than Chicago or LA. So it's a lot of people packed into a fairly small space.
Heather Schofield is a development economist at the University of Pennsylvania. These days, she spends much of her time in Chennai.
And everybody honks a lot because it's kind of a way of telling people where you are on the road and that you're coming. So it's pretty much constant auto horns all the time.
So you can imagine that sleep conditions in Chennai, with a lot of density, noise, poverty, are not quite optimal. Schofield says that a lot of families live in nothing more than an 8-by-10-foot room.
So there will be 3 or 4 other people in this 8-by-10 room with you trying to sleep at night. Anytime anyone rolls over, they probably wake up everybody else. It's incredibly hot. Chennai is a city where the average high temperature is 90 to 95 degrees throughout the entire year. There's no air conditioning. Maybe there's a fan if you're lucky. You're probably sleeping on a hard concrete floor. Most likely you don't even have a mattress or a pillow because it's hard to afford those goods. In addition, it's probably very loud. There are dogs barking, there are auto horns going at all hours. And if that weren't enough to make it really hard to sleep, there are probably mosquitoes there as well. It's a very tropical climate, so they're in there buzzing around your head, biting you, making you itchy. It's just an incredibly difficult environment to sleep in.
Development experts have been trying to help poor countries for decades. The sexiest prescriptions are often big, complicated, top-down projects. More recently, nutrition and education have been in vogue.
These other things like sleep, which somehow just haven't kind of entered into the popular belief as being important, maybe because it's not obvious that the poor would sleep worse, or maybe because it's not kind of immediate that it actually has these productivity effects, which is exactly why we're trying to study it and really understand what those implications are.
Okay, so how do you study that? Schofield and her colleagues are currently running a randomized controlled trial in Chennai with about 250 people. They all work in low-paying and very repetitive jobs like data entry. Schofield wants to learn if sleeping more will help them earn more money.
Basically, we'll conduct a lottery, and half the people in the study will be given things to help them sleep better at night. So we'll give them a mat to sleep on, something like a camping mat, which makes the surface softer. We'll give them a pillow so their neck isn't as stiff. We'll give them a light sheet and a fan to help keep the mosquitoes away. They'll also get an eye shade and earplugs to help deal with the light and the noise. In addition to that, we'll also ask them to take a nap in the office every day. They have that choice whether or not they want to, but there will be a very pleasant environment where they can go and it's cool and comfortable and can take the 20 or 30 minutes just to rest. Because there's actually pretty good evidence from work here in the U.S. and in other developed countries that short naps of 20 or 30 minutes could actually really improve your cognitive performance and your ability to kind of focus.
Running this experiment with people who do data entry for a living makes it pretty easy to measure any change in productivity.
So we can see everything that you do in doing your work. You know, are you, how many data points are you entering? When are you doing them? How quickly are you doing them? How accurate are you? And your work is compensated according to how much and how well you do. So if people improve their work, either in terms of quantity or quality, that'll actually play out in their earnings. We'll see their earnings increase as well.
It's too early to tell what this research will yield. But to Heather Schofield, experimenting with sleep was a no-brainer. She used to see people she knew, rickshaw drivers who'd been involved in earlier studies, for instance, falling asleep in the broiling sun.
If people are tired enough to be sleeping in the middle of the street in the 100-degree heat with trucks going by, it's pretty hard for them to be kind of as productive as possible in the labor force. So, you know, if we can help improve their sleep, our hypothesis is that it will actually very much improve their ability to both work longer and work harder and work better, you know, improve their performance on the job in quite a variety of different ways, and more broadly to just improve the choices that they're able to make.
When Freakonomics Radio returns, we take a look at sleep tips for anyone, and then we move on to another biological imperative, eating. We'll speak with Takeru Kobayashi, a competitive eating champion who took his sport to a whole new level. Why do you think others before you hadn't experimented so much?
Maybe because they're not as serious as I am. Maybe that's the only honest answer.
That's coming up after the break. And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, you can check out our entire podcast archive at freakonomics.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The research that Heather Schofield conducts has made her more aware of her own sleep deficits, especially because she's always flying back and forth between the U.S. and India.
It's this constant battle because I know from all the stuff that we're doing and all the research we're reading from other people that tells you all these things, the cognitive costs that come with, that I should be doing so much better on. But it's also a constant tension. You know, it's one of those things that there's a lot of other constraints on your time. And so I'm very aware of it, but it doesn't always make it easy to change. But I've also realized there are a lot of things potentially I could do to help myself sleep better at night, even if I'm not going to spend more time in bed.
For example, she bought a pair of high-end earplugs and learned the best technique for putting them in.
This is going to sound ridiculous, but imagine reaching your opposite arm over your head and then pulling up on your ear while you put the earplug in. That actually helps expand the ear canal a little bit so that the earplug actually gets kind of well settled in there when it expands and fills the space. So it actually blocks the noise much more effectively.
Oh my goodness. That works great. I also happen to wear earplugs when I sleep. I don't want to chance my 8 hours to some random garbage truck or car alarm. So thanks for the earplug tip, Heather. For some more sleep tips, we turn to Dan Pardee.
I'm the CEO of a company called Dan's Plan.
Dan's Plan is a sort of health consultancy in Northern California. Pardee does research with some scientists, and he works with a lot of people who are trying to optimize their sleep. For just about everyone, the goal is pretty simple.
So you want to wake refreshed and feel alert all day, every day. Cool. How do I do that?
He recommends that you start with a personal sleep experiment.
So instead of waking by an alarm clock, or by any sort of external means, you want to give yourself enough time in bed to wake upon its own volition. So the body wakes itself up and not by something else. And see you know, how much time is that? See how much time you need on average. Write it down. And having that number, that time in your mind clearly established, is a very, very good thing.
You need to do this for a few weeks, and now you can start planning for how long you need to spend in bed. Consistency is important.
And so if you're used to going to bed at midnight and getting up at 8, your body is primed to get really robust REM sleep around 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And so when you shift that, then you're not going to get as good of sleep as you would like.
If you're not sleeping well, if you find yourself exhausted during the middle of the day, Pardee thinks this may be caused by how you are receiving and processing light.
So light is very important for our health. Light enters into the eye, and it will communicate with a part of the brain, not the visual cortex, but another part of the brain that is referred to as the master clock. The scientific name is the suprachiasmatic nucleus. It's in the hypothalamus. And that part of the brain is keeping track of what time of day it is to say, okay, it's this time of day, do this type of activity. And so all of the body runs on these clocks, so it knows what to do when. 200 years ago, 90% of the United States was agrarian. So we were outside all day, tilling the fields, getting a lot of sun exposure. And then as the sun went down, the tone and the intensity of light would change. And that stimulates some darkness hormones, which facilitate the occurrence of sleepiness, which can then ushers in sleep. So now we spend 90% of our time indoors. That's a huge shift. And the intensity of light indoors is surprisingly different than the intensity of light outdoors.
The result is that we often don't get enough light during the day, but paradoxically, too much at night.
Now we can artificially manipulate our light environment the evening, and that's through room light and high-definition televisions and screens. And then that gives a daytime signal to the brain at night. And what ends up happening is those rhythms then become desynchronized. And we're basically creating a state of minor perpetual jet lag by the way that we live, by having mistimed lighting.
So what you want to do, Pardee says, is resync those rhythms. How does he do it? He has stopped wearing sunglasses. He gets outside as much as he can, even if it's just to make a phone call. And at night, he keeps the lights dim. He also wears a special pair of yellow-tinted glasses that filter out the kind of blue light that's emitted by artificial lights, including screens.
And what that means is that I can see, but I'm not telling my brain that it's day. And the reason of that is when blue light is entering the eye, it'll suppress the release of melatonin. And most people know melatonin as a sleepiness hormone. It's actually a darkness hormone. It has a modest soporific or sleep-inducing effect, but it's not very strong. But what it does is it tells the body that it's night. And the big benefit of that is I wake up much more refreshed the next day. I am ready to go, and I function pretty well all day long.
He makes it sound so easy, doesn't he? Of course, none of this takes into account the horn honking of Chennai or that ready-to-go two-year-old or any of the other sleep interrupters that all of us encounter.
My husband's not in town, and I never sleep well when he's not here.
But it's nice to see that people like Dan Pardee and Heather Schofield and Matthew Gibson and Lauren Hale are treating sleep so seriously. It's interesting. As obsessively as we measure so many things in society, especially our outcomes, health, wealth, education, productivity, we seem to spend a relatively small amount of time and effort really trying to understand how the inputs, the things that we control, affect those outcomes. Yeah, there are a lot of things beyond your control, but in terms of what you eat and drink, in terms of what kind of activities you do or don't do, and in terms of how much you sleep, well, those are in your hands alone. And after hearing from all these sleep experts the past two episodes, I'm convinced we'd all be better off if we paid a little bit more attention to sleep, learned about it, and thought up ways to help more people get more of it and better quality sleep. If we find out that engaging with your smartphone 30 minutes before bedtime really is that bad, well, let's just shut off the internet every night at 11. How's that? All right, that's probably not a very good solution, but you get the point. Now it's time to turn to something else that we all do every day, eating. Many of us think about finding a way to eat less. I'd like to introduce you to someone who's devoted his professional life to eating more. Kobe, can you just like count to 10 in your microphone?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Maggie, do the same or say anything you want. He just needs to get a level. Just keep talking.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I'd like you to meet Takeru Kobayashi, known as Kobe, and his translator, Maggie James. I was asking Kobe about his favorite foods.
Yogurt or tofu, kana?
You mean that yogurt and tofu?
Yogurt and tofu. Mm. What kind of tofu?
Yeah, あのね, すごい soft で.
Soft one.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite kind of steak? Or
filet.
Filet? You like filet. No fat. You like lean.
Lean, だね, そうだね.
Ah. Mm. What's your favorite fish?
Fish? Salmon 好きだけどね.
Salmon? Salmon. You like the skin or no?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite fruit?
いちごだよね. Strawberries.
Strawberries?
Mm.
How do you feel about hot dogs?
今の時期あんまり考えたくない食べ物だけどね、本当は。
During this time, it's actually the time that I don't want to think about hot dogs that much.
Takeru Kobayashi doesn't like to think about hot dogs much right now because he's preparing to eat a very large pile of them. Not for pleasure. This is what he does for a living. In the world of competitive eating, as the sport is known, Kobe is the biggest star that has ever been.
Maybe.
Yeah. It began back in Japan. He was a college student at the time, studying economics. A friend signed him up for a televised eating contest.
I was really shocked because at that time, I really didn't think that I could eat that much more than a normal person.
But he gave it a try, largely because of the prize money. $5,000 for first place. It was a four-stage eating contest, starting with boiled potatoes and then a seafood bowl, Mongolian mutton barbecue, finishing up with noodles. Your competitors were also amateurs, right? They weren't professionals?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So did you think you had a chance?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because why? What did you think that you could do better than the other amateurs? Was it mental or physical or strategic?
Total, I thought I could. Somewhere in between, maybe a mix.
There
were players that were much bigger than I was physically, even in Japan. So I didn't think that it could be, just a physical thing. Mm. It had to be total of mental and physical.
Kobe studied earlier contests like this one with qualifying stages. He saw that most people went so hard in the early rounds that even if they did advance, they didn't have the energy or the stomach capacity to finish strong. So he decided to eat just enough at each stage to qualify for the next. And when it came time for the final round, he blasted past the others and he won. Having tasted victory as an amateur competitive eater, Kobe immediately thought about turning pro. Now, the World Cup of Competitive Eating, as you probably know, is held every summer in New York City.
And only one location at the corner of Surf and Stillwell Avenues at Nathan's Famous. And why do they come? They come for the Nathan's Famous 4th of July International Hot Dog Eating Contest!
At home in Japan, Kobe began to train for Coney Island. American-style hot dogs were not available where he lived, so he used sausages made of minced fish. No hot dog buns either, so he cut bread down to size. He took his training seriously, very seriously. He began a long series of experiments. For instance, ripping the hot dog and bun in half before eating it, a move that would come to be known as the Solomon method, after the biblical story of King Solomon who threatened to settle a maternity dispute by slicing a baby in two pieces. The Solomon had been done before or no?
それはないだろうね。
No.
No. He found another way to speed things up.
セパレートにしたことかな?
Separating the sausage from the bun.
Yeah.
Also eating hot dogs two at a time.
Okay.
I don't mean two sticks of the same. I mean breaking one in half and eating two halves.
Mm-hmm. The sausage itself, being slick and dense, actually went down pretty easy. But eating a hot dog bun on its own, without the meat, it's harder than you'd think. How hard? You may have heard of the saltine challenge. Well, next time you want to win a bar bet, try the hot dog bun challenge. See if you can get somebody to try to eat two hot dog buns in 1 minute with no beverage. Here, listen to our Freakonomics Radio production team try it. This is David Herman doing the eating with Greta Cohn, Susie Lechtenberg, and Greg Rosalsky providing commentary.
Okay, I'm ready.
And go.
Oh yeah, I guess try.
So he's got half of a bun in his mouth.
35 seconds to go.
Swallow it.
I was so confident.
4, 3, 2, 1, and it's
put down the bun.
Not even one.
I'm feeling it. Yeah, not even one.
Wow.
I am ashamed.
So, to fight the dry bun problem, Kobe came up with a novel solution.
Dunking down there.
Dunking?
That's right, dunking. As he fed himself the bunless, broken hot dogs with one hand, he used the other hand to dunk the bun in water. Then he'd squeeze out the excess water and smush the bun into his mouth, kind of like a bun ball. Not only did this make eating faster, but now he didn't have to take time out between dogs to drink water. So breaking, separating, dunking. What about the shake?
Shake もやるね。Shake もやるやる。
でもその前にはやった見たことなかったですか？
ないね。俺はないね。
I had never seen that before. I think that was
誰かやってたかもしれないけど。
Maybe somebody was shaking, but I didn't. I had never seen that.
This became known as the Kobayashi Shake.
Successfully. Kobayashi now, look at him shaking, almost like Axl Rose on the stage of the Garden. Listen, you see the wiggle get there for Kobayashi. Just kind of moving it around like someone put an ice cube down your back. Look at that Kobayashi Shake. Chugging those hot dogs like a freshman at a keg party. It's unbelievable.
Kobe videotaped his training sessions. He charted all his data and analyzed it. He wanted to find out what worked, and just as important, what didn't work. At one point, he thought he should chew each dog very vigorously, but he realized this not only took too long, but it was also bad for his jaw. He was tireless in his experimentation. Why do you think others before you hadn't experimented so much?
本気じゃないってのが一番あるんじゃないかな。
Maybe because they're not as serious as I am. Maybe that's the only honest answer.
How did you get so serious?
なんかね、自分でやっててスポーツだなと思って、これで世界一になりたいなってすごく本気で思ったね。
Simply that when I tried it, I thought the physical action felt like this is a sport.
A sport. And nobody had treated it like a sport right. before.
And I simply wanted to be number one in the world at this.
No offense, but you sound crazy. It sounds nuts.
ごめんなさいけど、これ初めて聞いた人はあなたのこと crazy nuts だと思うからね。
And I say that with all due respect, because you know how much I love you, and respect what you've done. But what I mean by this is, you are bringing a level of scientific inquiry to an activity that nobody had bothered before. That's what I mean by nuts. So did you think it was nuts, or did it make perfect sense to you?
Now, I guess I'm a little older and more mature now, because now I can hear that and actually say like, oh, and laugh with you. But at that time, there was definitely not even a speck of me that would have thought that that was nonsense.
Yeah.
It just made sense.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how does Kobe do at the Coney Island hot dog contest?
Kid is incredible. A total beating of the Americans. He was like a conveyor belt. He was just putting them in two at a time.
And assuming that you are not interested in following Kobe's footsteps specifically, is there something more general that can be learned from his mastery of competitive eating?
I think the thing about human beings is that they make a limit in their mind of what their potential is, and they decide that, well, I've been told this, or this is what society tells me, and this is what, or they've just been made to believe something.
And one more thing. If you don't already subscribe to the Freakonomics Radio podcast, well, I think you should. It's free, comes out every week. You can get it at iTunes at Freakonomics.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today, we are telling the story of Takeru Kobayashi, who dreamed a dream of eating more hot dogs than any human being in history. This happens every 4th of July at Coney Island in New York City.
Nathan's annual hot dog eating contest is an international event. Champions from all over the world converging on Coney Island. Their
goal? The Coney Island contest had been going on for roughly 4 decades. The world record, 25 and 1/8 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. Okay, 25 and 1/8 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. Just picture that for a minute. Now, there aren't many rules. The competitors can have as much of whatever beverage they want. They can put condiments on the dogs, but no self-respecting eater is going to waste time or stomach capacity on ketchup. All the dogs and buns that enter your body must, well, they have to stay in your body. If not, this is known in the sport as a reversal of fortune, you can be disqualified. Okay, so it is July 4th, 2001. Kobe is 23 years old. It's only 5'8". 130 pounds. So when you showed up that first time to compete, did you feel that you belonged on the stage with the other competitors? Did you feel you were justified to be there?
I actually didn't think even about that. I wasn't thinking about that at all, but I was full of the feeling of I've come here to win.
So the bell rings. And you start to eat, and for 12 minutes you eat, and you break, and you separate, and you slurp, and you dunk, and you smush, and you swallow, and you shake, and you do all that. And then the bell rings, and then you see your number. Yes, is that, did you, were you paying attention to your number before that, or did you only see your number at the very end?
I only saw it at the end. I wasn't looking at all the numbers.
And what was the number?
50.
The Americans just dropped their dogs in awe. The clear-cut wiener, Kobayashi, who inhaled 50 hot dogs in 12 minutes, shattering the world record.
The kid is incredible. A total beating of the Americans. He was like a conveyor belt. He was just putting them in two at a time.
I saw he was around 30 when I was at around 8. I took my shirt off, started waving the white flag.
I can't believe it. The record, new record. 50.
50. And the previous record was 25 and 1/8, right?
Yes.
So you doubled the world record. So nobody doubles any world record ever. And what did you think then? What did you think when you saw that number of 50?
I was actually shocked. I was not imagining at all that I would eat double. So it was super surprising to me.
Everyone was surprised. And some people were skeptical. They wondered if Kobe was playing by the rules.
They said that they took me to outer space and that that some aliens had given the man two stomachs. Oh, he's taking muscle relaxers.
That you were doping, yeah. Did you take muscle relaxers?
No.
Do you have two stomachs?
No.
he thought about it.
He won Coney Island 6 straight years, and a lot of other eating contests, too.
106 tacos!
337 wings!
A new record for the most grilled cheese sandwiches in 1 minute is 13!
Who took down an entire 12-inch pizza in 1 minute flat?
Let's make some noise for the one and only, the culinary Houdini, the best eater on earth,
Kobe was not, however, unbeatable. Tell me about the bear.
And now introducing to my right, his opponent, the Beast. He descends from Kodiak Island, Alaska.
Kobe tried to beat the bear in a contest that was taped for Fox TV.
This beast stands over 8 feet tall and weighs in tonight at 1,089 pounds. He can digest over 60 pounds of food in a 24-hour period. He possesses the ultimate appetite for destruction. Meet the Beast, the Alaskan Cruncher!
Even against a bear, Kobe thought he'd win.
Now again, the contest begins as soon as the bear eats the first hot dog. And it is underway.
There we go.
Here we go.
Kobayashi is the greatest.
And in this case, the dogs had no buns, right? Why was that? Were the buns bad for the bear?
Bear は食べないって言われた。
I was told that the bear does not eat buns.
Well, tough for the bear. I mean, okay, so you're told. So the bear had a better lawyer than you had, apparently. Okay, so was there a rehearsal?
Rehearsal.
Yes, there was a rehearsal.
あったね。
And what happened at the rehearsal?
ベアに勝ったんだよね。
I wanted the rehearsal.
When the bear came out, I saw a flash of fear for a second in Kobayashi's eyes.
And then in the contest itself, what happened?
いや、コンテストになったら、リハーサルの時とは考えられない。これ早いんだよね、ベアが。
When the real time came for it, the bear was really quick, like very fast.
そう、だからすごい驚いてね。
I was so shocked.
焦ったね、本当に。
I suddenly kind of almost panicked a little bit.
I don't see how he can beat this bear.
This is going to be
it. And that is it. We have a winner.
It's
the bear, the beast, has won.
The Alaskan Cruncher is our new champion.
Yes.
And the bear beat you. The bear won.
Mm.
Did you ever figure out how the bear did so well in the competition versus the practice?
Yeah, それはもちろんね、聞いとかないといけないことだからね。飼い主がね、食べさせなかったね。しばらく。
Of course, that was the first question that I thought I had to know. So, I asked, and I was told that the bear keeper had not given him anything to eat for like a day
until coming in.
So they had actually kind of made the bear very hungry, and when it came in, it was starving.
向こうは動物だからね、やっぱりね、そのハングリーだとかね、アプタイトで食うんだよね。
My competitor was a wild beast, and when animals, when they are hungry, they are different living things. They are.
僕はね、お腹空いたからすごい食べれるわけではないから、お腹空かしてもしょうがないんだけど。
I was, yeah, I'm not a strong eater because I'm hungry, whereas I was competing against a beast that was very hungry.
Sometimes you get the bear, and sometimes the bear gets you. Tonight, the bear got Kobayashi.
How do you handle defeat?
気持ちを切り替えますね。
I always change my mentality very quickly. Simply said, sometimes you win because someone's having a bad day, and sometimes somebody beats you because you're having a bad day. Even winning or losing doesn't necessarily even mean really that you're the best. So when you look at the long run, you can't think about you and competing against a rival or rivals. That doesn't even really tell you 100% that you're the best. What you can only do is compare yourself to yourself and try to see how far you can actually go.
So, what did Kobayashi do that was different than everyone before him? Here's one thing. He redefined the problem that he was trying to solve.
The key to me was that I had to change the mentality that it was a sport. It wasn't having a meal. It was, to me, I had to think, this is a sport. It has nothing to do with how you normally enjoy a meal. It's just a physical action. My honest opinion was that people were just eating as an extension of regular eating meals. And it looked like they were all like rushing to try to eat more than they normally could, just one more hot dog, just a little more. And I thought, well, if you just look at it as a way of trying to put something in instead of how much more can I eat than normal, then it really just takes a few questions and a little research on my part and experimentation to see how far I could actually go.
Here's what the other competitive eaters were asking themselves. How can I fit more hot dogs in my stomach? Kobe asked a different question, only slightly different perhaps, at least to a layperson, but it changed everything. His question was, how can I make one hot dog easier to eat? But it wasn't just that. If everyone before him was asking the wrong question, he thought, then maybe he shouldn't give much credence to the existing world record. Maybe it was an artificial barrier that he should just bust right through. This contest had been going on for over 40 years. Why is it that it took until you to kind of change the mental and strategic approach to this sport?
I
think people have to have a reason to rethink what could be wrong. If a whole 40-something years or more, if people only see someone eating 25 as the limit, then someone who can eat 20 might think, wow, if I just eat 5 more, I could actually do that. And no one would ever think that anything else could be done. But if you see someone suddenly come and eat 50, then everyone knows that there must be a different approach to the problem. And until something like that happens, people don't question. So maybe I was the reason, maybe I gave them a reason for everyone at the same moment to rethink the problem again.
So I'm curious if you could look around the world at whether it's something having to do with money or government or education, can you point to something where if people could only rethink the problem, redefine the problem like you did, and not accept the limit of the old world record like you did, can you think of an instance where it might not be so hard to do that, where we'd all be better off if people could do that?
I think it should be used for everything. I think the thing about human beings is that they make a limit in their mind of what their potential is, and they decide that, I've been told this, or this is what society tells me, or this is what, or they've just been made to believe something. So if every human being actually threw away those thoughts and they actually did use that method of thinking to everything, the potential of human beings, I think, is really great. I think it's huge compared to what they actually think of themselves. So that is a factor that should be, I mean, if everyone could use it for everything, then everything could be much better.
There's a good bit of evidence that Kobe is right about how artificial barriers can hold us back. He no longer laps the field in competitive eating contests. In fact, Kobe was beaten for several years at Coney Island by an eater named Joey Chestnut, who's still the reigning champion. And the guys who used to eat just 15 or 20 hot dogs now routinely eat 30 and 40. Some of them use Kobe's methods. All of them benefit from knowing that the old limits weren't real. As for Kobe himself, he lives in New York now, but still travels the world eating for a living. But you won't find him in Coney Island on July 4th anymore. A few years back, he got into a contract dispute with the organizers, so he started his own hot dog eating contest, which also takes place in New York on July 4th. These days, the hot dog eating contest runs only 10 minutes, but the numbers are even higher. How many do you think you'll eat this year?
More than 72.
More than 72. So more than 6 dozen hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes on 4th of July. What will you do then on the 5th of July?
Just resting. I think just resting.
How long does it take to recover?
It depends on how I feel, but I'd like to rest for at least half a day.
Oh, that's it. You must be a great athlete, because most of us, if we eat even 3 hot dogs, we need to rest for a whole day. So not only are you better on the front end, you're better on the back end, too. That's it for this week's Freakonomics Radio. I'm Stephen Dubner. Thanks for listening. And one more thing, we want to hear from you for a new episode we're working on. It's about handwriting. Seriously, handwriting is either essential to how our brains learn.
Particularly for conceptual questions, laptop note takers did significantly worse than students who took notes longhand.
Or handwriting is a completely obsolete practice, the teaching of which borders on torture.
He was having to stay in every single day for recess of second grade because he got his G's backwards.
So we want to hear what you think about writing by hand. When you do it, and why or why not. Use whatever voice memo app is on your phone to make a brief audio recording. Brief, I said. And email us the file at radio@freakonomics.com. Please be sure to include your name, where you live, and what you do. No pen or paper necessary. And thanks.